Paul's great appeal in the early part of this passage is that Christians in Philippi will live humbly, generously, and unselfishly while being thoughtfully concerned about the welfare of those around them. And if we were to ask Paul, why should Christians live humbly, generously, unselfishly, while being thoughtfully concerned for the welfare of those around them, then he would answer, because that's the way Christ lived. That's the way Christ lived. And we are called to be like-minded, having the same love. We are called to be godly. You know, Christ shared the very nature of God on earth and acted out that nature and showed by what he chose to do that God's true nature is not characterized by seizing or grasping or attaining. Rather, God's true nature is characterized by sharing, serving, sacrificing, being open-handed, and pouring out one's life for others in order that others might be enriched. That is the characteristics of God himself, and that was visualized to us through Jesus Christ when he came to earth. And clearly, if we want to be true image bearers of God, then that same attitude has to be found in us. In other words, that Christ's attitude needs to govern all our conduct as well. Now, in this passage, we're introduced to two of Paul's co-workers and friends who clearly sought to model the attitude of Christ in everything that they did. And their names are Timothy and Epaphroditus. And Timothy had accompanied Paul on his missionary journeys, including his journey to Philippi, and he had spent time in prison with him. He had been a loyal friend and utterly reliable in the work of the Lord with Paul. And now, at this point, Timothy is with Paul, who is in prison in Rome, waiting the outcome of his trial. And Paul is optimistic that he is going to be released from prison in the near future. And as soon as the outcome is known, he will send Timothy to Philippi to share the good news. And then he hopes to travel on himself later. And in this letter to the Philippians, Paul pays tribute to Timothy. He says, "I have no one else like him who takes a genuine interest in your welfare." And Paul is saying here to the Philippians, Timothy is genuine. There's nothing manufactured or artificial about his interest and care for others. His interest in others was a genuine product of a regenerated nature that had been nourished by the example of Paul himself. He was a true son of his spiritual father. Now, Paul acknowledges that this quality is rare. As he looks around, he sees the blight of self-interest everywhere. People are looking out for themselves. There is little genuine interest in the welfare of others. Now, nothing much has changed in 2,000 years. We live in an age that is also blighted by self-interest, and genuine concern is on the wane. We're very much a me culture, and that's partly why we're so unhappy. I was interested to learn that Britain is 35% less happy than it was in the 1950s. And one of the reasons that was given for the unhappiness is the rise of meism and the decline in people's involvement in voluntary services. We're not so interested in the welfare of others as we used to be back in the 1950s. And as a result, conversely, we're not so happy. Now, against this unhappy background of meism, there's a growing opportunity for Christians to show genuine concern. A genuine concern that springs from a regenerated nature that is sensitive to God's leading and eager to display concern and compassion in the church and in the city. I was at a meeting this week in town where all the people that are involved in compassion ministries of the city were all sharing about their work. And it was an evening where Christ and the welfare of others was at the centre, right at the heart. And it was an evening of great joy. There was quite a number of folks here from Deeside there that night. And it was an evening of great joy. That's the only way to describe it. And I actually have my notes here, what Michael spoke on today, that means really Jesus first, others second, and ourselves last. And there's some great people in this city that are displaying the fruits of genuine concern for others. And it's a real blessing to be influenced by that kind of group in many ways that, in a sense, are not shackled to self-interest. I was away in Glasgow on a course with regards to urban mission, and had the privilege of meeting some interesting people who work in the inner city of London. And I was deeply challenged by this Dutch fellow called Hank, who's just in his early 30s, and he works with the Bangladeshi community in London. And the Bangladeshi community live just across the Thames from London's massive, prosperous banking community. And the Bangladeshi community are believed to be the poorest community in the whole of Western Europe. And Hank runs a cafe there, and it's staffed by Bangladeshi women. And one of the girls that works in the cafe hadn't turned up for a few days, so he went to visit her in her home to find out why she hadn't come. And she just opened up to him about the distress of her life. She lived in real poverty. She'd been mentally and sexually abused as a child. Her mother was schizophrenic and seriously ill. And through her job in the cafe, she was the only one bringing any income to the family to feed herself, her mother, and all her sisters. She'd gone to the bank just a few days before to deposit what she could, and the contribution was so small that the bank teller had actually laughed at her. And she was overwhelmed just by the despair and the poverty of her situation. And what Hank said to me really touched me. He said he was so overwhelmed by her situation, I've given you a very short version today, that when he got home, he was physically sick because he had been so moved with compassion for this family. And he's worked there for 7 years in a really difficult situation. There's never been a night in which he hasn't had someone living in his home as he sought to love and care for these people. And it hasn't all been plain sailing. It wasn't that long ago when a bunch of Bangladeshi youth came round and they beat him up and they broke his nose and told him that he shouldn't be speaking about Jesus, and if he carried on speaking about him, they might come back and they might kill him. And yet he continues to work there. And his story made me think about the things that we get sick about. You know, maybe our football team loses and we're maybe sick about that. Lots of things that we get sick about stem from deep self-interest, while we often remain blessedly detached from the Spirit of Christ and the welfare of humanity. And when I looked at Hank, I saw somebody that genuinely had the concerns of others above himself and the concerns of Jesus Christ. And it was a deep challenge to me to meet someone like that who is truly living the way Timothy spoke about Paul. He was not blighted by self-interest. Real compassion, real joy, real character. Now, Timothy was a man of character when it comes to Christ-centeredness and genuine concern. Paul says he has proved himself. He's proved himself, and it's all to do with character. Our modern world wants charisma far more than character, and that's because this is a me age where we celebrate surface over depth, where we are far more impressed by image and the cult of personality than we are in genuine character. But genuine character counts. And there are three aspects to character: the core, consistency, and the cost. And the core of character is essential, is the essential stuff a person is made of. The inner reality and quality in which a person's thoughts, his speech, his decisions, his behavior, his relationships are rooted. And what a person is at the core is best seen in what we do consistently. Not what we do through random acts. I heard a story recently about a man I know who got carried away at a charity function. And he gave away lots of money. And those that know him best said it was completely out of character, because he's known generally as a man who is terribly grippy. But it was a one-off random act. And although it was a good deed, and it wasn't what he did consistently. Now, Paul had plenty of opportunity to see all sides of Timothy's character over a long period of time. And he knew that his genuine concern for others in putting Christ first in everything was not random acts. Far from it. He practiced a long obedience in the same direction. And that's what God calls from us as well, isn't that right? A long obedience in the same direction. He had been consistent through the years. It's easy to practice a random act of genuine concern, especially when we're caught up in something or others are watching. But the challenge here is to be consistently and genuinely concerned about putting Christ first in our lives and also the welfare of others. And this kind of consistency does not come without cost. As Hank knew, and as others know as well, and that's the third thing about character, the cost. For the nature of consistent core character is usually revealed in the crucible of suffering. Isn't that right? In testing. We don't grow without testing. And Timothy, no doubt, along with Paul, had been tested and tried many times as they sought to live the gospel. They had suffered together for the sake of Christ. They had known persecution and rejection. But in all that testing, they had continued to practice the habits of the heart. And that was Christ-centered living and genuine concern for others. And that's a challenge for us. What is the stuff of life like at the core of our being? Is there a deep self-interest there? Or are we becoming more Christ-centered and others-orientated? Are we submitting ourselves to character formation through the Spirit? Are we proving ourselves to be people who genuinely have Christ's interest as number one in our heart and a genuine concern for others? Well, Paul's not afraid to hold Timothy up as one who has an attitude to be followed, one who has proved himself, one who was Christ-centered and genuinely interested in the welfare of others. Now, Paul also wanted to say a little to the Philippian church about Epaphroditus. Now, I mentioned earlier that Paul was being held a prisoner in Rome, waiting his appearance before Caesar. Now, normally, Paul would have worked with his hands to support himself, but being in prison, he couldn't do that. And the Philippian church decided to send him a gift and to send him care. You know, where someone could go and care for Paul while he was in prison. And they sent a gift and care in the form of this man, Epaphroditus. Now, somewhere along the line, Epaphroditus became seriously ill. In fact, it looked like he was going to die. Now, Paul thinks highly of Epaphroditus. He calls him his brother, fellow worker, and fellow soldier. And these three words are arranged in ascending order that describe what they share together, a common bond, a common work, and a common danger and toil and suffering. And Epaphroditus' name suggests that his parents may have devoted him to the service of Aphrodite, the goddess of love and patron of gambling. Plutarch tells us that the highest cast of the dice is called the Epaphroditus. Now, we have no way of knowing whether or not he had been devoted to the service of Aphrodite or not, but we know that he seems to have lived up to his name and that Epaphroditus was a risk taker. We're not told the exact nature of the risk, but we know from the first century prisons were notorious places for catching infections and diseases. In fact, in the first century, some Christians who visited prisons regularly at that time were known as the gamblers. And they were known as the gamblers because they just didn't know what they might catch when they were in there. They were terrible places. Sometimes we forget Craig Inches is a dream compared to the early prisons. And that's one possibility. He may have caught something just by going in to visit Paul frequently. Or it might have been just he might have risked draining his life in excessive work for the kingdom, that he gave his all. Paul certainly says he almost died for the sake of the work of Christ. So here is a man, whatever the reason, we know for the sake of the gospel and loyalty to Paul, this dear brother was prepared to risk all. I love that poem, Risk. To love is to risk appearing a fool. To weep is to risk appearing sentimental. To reach out is to risk involvement. To disclose feelings is to risk disclosing yourself. To place your dreams before a crowd is to risk their love. To live is to risk dying. To hope is to risk despair. To try is to risk failure. But the greatest hazard in life is to risk nothing. For one who risks nothing, does nothing, and has nothing, and is nothing, they may avoid suffering and sorrow, but simply cannot learn, change, grow, or love. Only one who risks is free. Well, Epaphroditus, rather than risk nothing, risked everything for the sake of the kingdom. And no doubt as a result he learned and changed and grew and loved. For even when he fell seriously ill, it was not his illness that distressed him. Rather, he was distressed that the church back home would be anxious to know he was so unwell. I had to smile about this. You know, when we're ill, we suffer from the very opposite, you know. What do you mean you didn't know I was ill? You know, I've been ill for a month. Nobody noticed, you know. Haven't had any Gatewell cards, you know. Well, Epaphroditus was blessed with a warm-hearted, other-centered self-forgetfulness, which is a wonderful, attractive quality. And Paul had deep affection for his Gentile comrade. In fact, one of the most touching things about this letter is that we're not only exposed to Paul the theologian, but to Paul the man. And this section gives us insight into Paul's feelings and emotions. He wasn't all deep, dense, and theological. Far from it. He confessed here to being truly horrified at the thought of losing Epaphroditus. In verse 27, it's most revealing. Epaphroditus was ill and almost died. But God had mercy on him. And not only on him, but also on me, to spare me sorrow upon sorrow. And Paul is saying here, if Epaphroditus had died, it would have resulted for me in sorrow being piled upon sorrow. He would have been truly overwhelmed. Now, this is encouraging because we learn through this that Paul's not some stiff upper lip stoic that expresses no emotion or feels no emotion, who lives detached and aloof in his theology. Far from it. He's bound by ties of real human affection and love to his colleagues, especially those who have worked and struggled with him in the gospel. And he's refreshingly honest here. He didn't want to hide from this young church his own struggles, his own vulnerability and fear of sorrow. And it's good to know that he felt that way because he was a deeply spiritual man. Now, why is that important? Well, because a lot of Christian literature today would have you believe that if you're walking with Jesus, all is sweetness and light, no struggles, no strains, and certainly no sorrow piled upon sorrow. But that's not true. Sometimes life can throw at us sorrow piled upon sorrow. And when we're in that place, we must not seek to deny our true emotion just because it doesn't fit in with the trendy triumphalism of today. No, we need to be real and honest. And like Paul, share with the church or with our home group. This is really where I'm at right now. You know, it was a very touching moment a few months back when Rona stood up here and shared just how she was, yeah? And that's what the church needs to do. It needs to embrace those that are feeling the strains of life. You know, I know Rona received many phone calls and cards through that, and it was an opportunity for the church to embrace, you know. And I think Paul's teaching that here. He's not afraid to share this is where he is and how he would have been if Epaphroditus had died. You know, the church is here to embrace, and certainly the home groups as well. It's very important that. It's maybe not easy, but it's healthy and most necessary for our spiritual good. So let's not take our cue from the pop Christian reductionism. You know, there's so many of these books today which would have you believe that life is just all triumphant. It's not true. It's not true. And Paul knew that he was feeling deep sorrow, and he would have if Epaphroditus had died. Now, thanks to God's grace, Epaphroditus recovered, and Paul was delighted to send him on his way, and he encouraged the church to give him a hail and hearty welcome when he came back. In fact, he says, welcome him in the Lord with great joy and honor him. Why honor him, Paul? Well, because he almost died for the work of Christ. Here's a man who displays the attitude of Christ in his innermost being. A man who was a risk taker, who genuinely put the welfare of others before himself. And Paul says, that's the kind of man you need to honor. That's the kind of woman you need to honor in your church. Now, sadly, we live today in a me first because I'm worth it celeb type culture. We've embraced the gospel of the pop prophets and the cult of personality. And the celebs are the people we fall over ourselves to honor today. Isn't that the case? It's rather pathetic. And we know all their names and all their ratings. Yet lamentably, we don't know the names of those who have lived for the gospel. I wonder how many of you have heard of this man, Andrew Reed. I've actually studied this at the moment for my course and have to give a seminar on this when I go back. But I just want to tell you about Andrew Reed. What an inspiration this man is. Andrew Reed, genuine interest in the welfare of others. Andrew Reed was truly one of England's Victorian greats. He built a church in his early 20s from 100 to over 2,000 in 50 years as a pastor in New Road Chapel in London. But Reed's genuine concern for people extended well beyond the walls of his church. In his surrounding area, near the London docks where he ministered, there were thousands of families living in slum conditions. Many of the families were suddenly hit by tragedy or disease, leaving many children bereft of a parent or two. And Reed was deeply moved what he saw and decided to do something about it. And after taking two orphans into his home, he was convicted that he needed to establish an orphanage for children over seven. And this was not without its problems. The first meeting to promote the orphanage was poorly attended. And despite hundreds being invited, only 70 people turned up and the collection taken was a mere £66. And Reed left the meeting deeply despondent. But he encouraged himself in the Lord and pressed on, convicted that he was right. Eventually, after much travail, he realized his project, the London Orphan Asylum, where he showed genuine concern for hundreds and hundreds of children. Now, most of us would have been content with a church to run and one orphanage, but Reed didn't stop there. His compassion was also for the under sevens as well. So he sought financial help from business people, believing that their hearts could be softened and changed if they caught the vision for orphans. And he built another project and established another orphanage called the Infant Orphan Asylum. And motivated by the habits of his heart and the long obedience in the same direction, he didn't stop there. He established another orphanage called the Orphanage for Fatherless Children. And later in life, he became increasingly aware and uneasy about the plight of those with learning disabilities, who at that time were either totally ignored or became the object of amusement. And he was convinced that those with learning disabilities could flourish within a happy, loving, active, progressive Christian environment. And so he established a home for learning disabilities for children, first one in Britain. And then when he was 60 years old and weary, and having lived a very active life for the Lord, he set out to establish one last project, seeking to provide care for those suffering from strokes and accidents in which there was little hope of improvement. And his last project was called the Hospital for the Incurables, which today, of course, is the Royal Hospital for Neurodisability in Putney. Now, Reed was often misunderstood, ridiculed by his opponents, betrayed by those sometimes who sat on his boards. He was hampered by narrow religious bigotry, but Reed soldiered on. He was a giant of faith and self-discipline, a man marked by great self-denial, huge generosity, whose philanthropy even rubbed off on royalty, who gave generously to his charities. He believed every individual had value simply because they were made in the image of God. And by the time he died in 1862, when he's over 70, he was known simply as the orphan's friend who had provided homes for 6,400 children. He was an extraordinary man, and yet today, largely unknown and largely forgotten and little honored. And Andrew Reid is a challenge to us today as the welfare state and its benefits recedes and inner city challenges increase, not to mention the enormous challenges of the 11 million AIDS orphans in Africa. We desperately need something of Reid's spirit and compassion and dogged determinism today. You know, I was greatly touched by the story of Pat Briggs. Pat, I believe, was here just a few weeks ago when I was away. Just an ordinary lady who was doing an extraordinary job, making soup, lots of soup. And all the profits from that soup is going towards orphans in Africa. You know, sometimes we think we can't make a difference. But there she is. She's got her soup, she has her compassion, her faith and hard work, and she's making a difference for a lot of people. You know, what a challenge that is. A simple story. Ordinary people doing extraordinary things. And that's what the church needs to do more and more today. What a challenge that is, I think. You know, if the evangelical church is going to do anything today, it must return to its roots, the spirit of the likes of the Andrew Reeds, when they rose up to make a difference in the nation. And that's where we need to return today. We need to catch that spirit that we might make a difference. And that brings us right back to Paul's appeal to the Christians in Philippi, that as followers of Christ, we must not be characterized by self-interest, seizing, grasping, attaining, obsessed with getting our own advantage. These are not the values of the kingdom of God, but rather characterized by humility, content with the status of a servant, sharing, sacrificing, being open-handed, and pouring out our lives for others in order that others might be enriched. That's Paul's challenge to us today. May God help us to break the stranglehold of the meism in this generation through genuine concern and compassion for a lost world. If we risk nothing, then we gain nothing. May God help us to follow in the steps of Jesus, Paul, Timothy, Epaphroditus, Andrew Reid, and many others, that the kingdom of God may be manifest among us in tangible ways today.